hour of Up and Adam, presented by Sanvold and Associates Financial Services Group.
Up and Adam. I am Andrew Lee. Happy New Year, the final show of 2015. Jack Tomczak out on vacation. He'll be back on Monday.
No!
I think I'm going to call him later in the show. I want to talk some smack about this weekend's Vikings-Packers game.
Yes.
Yeah, I got a wager I want to make with him.
I like it. What are you going to wager?
Well, he won't bet money, and I don't blame him. You know,
he doesn't have any.
Right, exactly. I know what he makes. So I figure the next best option is public humiliation.
I am all for that.
Yeah,
I don't think it's possible to humiliate Jack. I think he lacks the capacity.
The gene.
Yeah, right. He doesn't recognize when it's appropriate to feel shame.
Right.
So
the shame gene.
That's bad.
That's pretty harsh.
You don't want to be that guy. He's got the same affect that Hillary Clinton has. That's serious. It's pretty serious.
She got that from Bill, though.
Well, that was
acquired over time.
Evolved.
True. Yeah.
Osmosis.
Joining us with Nick Zerwas, Walter Hudson in for Jack Tomczak, and fourth wheeling this morning, friend of the Beercast. We've had him on the Beercast a number of times, which you can hear on the Twin Cities New Talk Podcast Network. Lawyer extraordinaire Jeffrey O'Brien, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Brought you in because I wanted to talk about liquor laws, Sunday sales, the state of the craft beer industry in Minnesota. I think it's been an interesting and more productive than non-productive year for those of us that are advocating for looser liquor laws, things like that. We made some gains here and there, and maybe get a preview of what to look forward to in 2016. And we are going to get to that, but one more story out of the news bag that I wanted to get all of your takes on before we move on, brought to us by Key Cadillac. This was in the Star Tribune, actually late last week. This initial story came out, and there was an update yesterday. The Minnesota Vikings want to stop Wells Fargo from putting up mounted illuminated signs on the rooftops of two new Minneapolis office towers because they say they violate an agreement and threatened to photobomb the image of the U.S. Bank Stadium in Downtown East, according to a Hennepin County District Court lawsuit. Vikings Vice President Lester Bagley said Wednesday of last week that Wells Fargo's steps to install the signs violate a February 2014 agreement between the bank and the team referred to in the lawsuit as Minnesota Vikings Football Stadium LLC. The dispute is also a multi-million dollar battle of bank branding. U.S. Bank has paid undisclosed millions to the Vikings to inscribe its name on the new stadium for the next two decades, including a massive logo across the roof visible from passing airplanes. In a statement on Wednesday, Wells Fargo spokesman John Hobot said, "We are satisfied with the signage package that was approved for our $300 million community investment initiative for our new campus in the historic Downtown East neighborhood. For more than 2 years, the subject of signage on the two 17-story Wells Fargo towers adjacent to the stadium has been intensely negotiated, mostly in private. The history and legal rights behind the size of the signs involve a tangle of Minneapolis zoning ordinances, site plans, and interests, including those of developer Orion Companies, the banks, the Vikings, and the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority." The lawsuit said Wells Fargo started installing mounted illuminated signs in an effort, this is in quotes, in an effort to permanently photobomb the image of the iconic U.S. Bank. Can you call it iconic? It's not even built yet.
It's already pretty big in there.
So basically, Wells Fargo wants to put these signs up that any blimp shots of the stadium that, you know, get the big U.S. Bank logo, they're going to be visible in all of those shots. The Vikings say, no, this is photobombing.
So to me, I think the operative consideration here is this agreement that they keep referencing. Mm-hmm. This is an agreement between Wells Fargo and the Vikings, or is it an agreement between U.S. Bank and the Vikings?
According to the lawsuit, that the Vikings filed, the Vikings and Wells Fargo agreed that the only rooftop signs on the two towers would be, quote, non-mounted and not illuminated.
Well, in that case, they might actually have a case.
If that's what the agreement does actually say, yes.
Because my initial impression of this was that the Vikings were just trying to say, hey, you know, this is supposed to be a U.S. Bank stadium, and you're going to be, quote-unquote, photobombing us, and we have no actual legal basis for complaint, but we're just going to try to get you to stop anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But if this is something that they have been in negotiations with for some time and have actually come to some sort of binding legal agreement on, then they might have something.
The issue is significant. This is according to the story. The issue is significant because the stadium area and the surrounding logos are likely to appear on countless national television broadcasts. In August 2014, months after the initial agreement was signed, Wells Fargo asked the Vikings to amend the signage agreement to allow for rooftop signs with raised illuminated lettering mounted on beams more than a foot above the roof rather than painted on the roof as agreed upon. At the time, Wells Fargo also warned the Vikings that if the team did not agree to the change, that the bank would circumvent the agreement by lighting the entire roof of each of the tower, including the signs, and then more than a year of discussions found no resolution. So they do appear to have an agreement between the Vikings and Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo wanted to amend that agreement. The Vikings wouldn't agree to amend it, so Wells Fargo is moving ahead with the signs they want to put up anyway, and now the Vikings are asking federal court. It's actually been moved to federal court to intervene on their behalf.
Guess it all depends ultimately on what that agreement says.
Yeah, the language of the agreement is going to end up being key.
Yeah.
The specific language.
Yeah, if Wells Fargo probably has attorneys that have their own interpretation of what mounted and illuminated mean.
Right.
And that's and there's going to ultimately be a judge deciding what the terms of the agreement mean.
Right.
Interesting.
Mm. It is interesting. I love the idea though of photobombing. You're photobombing our blimp shots.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Yeah.
I mean, of course Wells Fargo knows what they're doing. Of course they wouldn't be spending, several million dollars on these signs if they weren't going to get some national TV coverage out of it.
You know, if the story really picks up and becomes a thing that people are talking about, Wells Fargo would be well served to come up with some advertisements of just like an obnoxious guy in a Wells Fargo t-shirt who goes around jumping in front of people's cameras. I mean, that could be viral, potentially.
Yeah.
Do it on YouTube. Be nice.
So the case is going to U.S. District Court, and we'll see how that plays out. It'll be interesting.
Not just a guy in the Wells Fargo shirt, though. I want, like, something going on, and then just that iconic red stagecoach.
Yeah.
Just to, like, tear through.
Yeah, right.
Like someone's family reunion, someone's picnic. Just...
All right, we're running a little bit behind on a break, so we'll go ahead and take that. We'll come back with Jeffrey O'Brien, Walter Hudson, Nick Zerwas. We're going to start talking about one of my favorite subjects, beer. All that more, plus your call, 651-989-5855 when we come back.
Follow Twin Cities News Talk at TC News Talk on Twitter for the latest news updates and more. Get the links at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
And make sure to use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter.
To insult Andrew.
To communicate with the show.
Tweet your insults at Andrew. Hashtag TCNT.
You do plenty of that.
Tweet insults at you.
No, you just give them to me.
She's standing right here. Why would she need to tweet?
Yeah,
she
comes why would in
during
I need
the breaks just to be. Every once in a while, she'll come in during the break and she'll go, "Oh, Andrew, by the way, you're bald."
I'm just letting you know, like, in case you forgot, you need to be aware of that, right? Wouldn't you want to know?
Right, yeah. No, I do forget sometimes.
I would.
Yeah. I've got so much unused hair product at my house because it's really when you forget when you're in the grocery store and you're like, I should get some shampoo.
Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So many unused bottles.
If you really want to hit him between the eyes, you need to get a little bit more existential. You need to come in and be like, you've peaked.
No, one
it's
time
all
I had
downhill.
One time I had a conversation with him and I informed him that he's more than double my age.
There you go.
Yeah, and then she followed it up with, think of all the amazing things I'm going to accomplish over the course of my life. Because you're double my age, and I'm already pretty much where you are.
That is, I did not say that.
Wow.
I've secured a spot on a morning radio program, and I'm less than half your age.
That is mean.
Think of how great my life's going to be.
You are the cruelest.
She's dark.
I mean, just throwing down, just dropping truth.
Yeah, I mean,
just
for someone painful, who's so bubbly and friendly and adorable, big
on
smile,
air.
You know, it just seems like just a sparkling personality. Oh, she is dark.
She's my kind of person. She's my people.
Dark side to her.
I just like to keep everybody a little
miserable.
Like give a little realism.
But to be fair, Walter's 100% right. That's the on-air lump. Yeah. Off-air lump's like, I hate that guy.
No, I gave him a gift this morning. That's how
she
nice
did.
I am.
She did. She gave me a little raccoon.
Yeah. Very cute.
It's adorable.
It's a live raccoon. I don't know how wise I was bringing it here.
That's why I'm leaving it in there with you.
Yeah. It's really sweet.
All right. Welcome back to the program. I am Andrew Lee. Jack Tomczyk will be back on Monday. We're joined by Nick Zerwas, Walter Hudson, and a friend of the Minnesota Beer Cast. First time on this show, I believe. Lawyer extraordinaire Jeffrey O'Brien from...
I love you. Loman Abdo.
I wanted to bring you in because you work with a lot of breweries, mm-hmm. distilleries. You're very well versed on Minnesota liquor laws and the regulatory state of alcohol and liquor in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to sort of recap some of what happened in 2015, look ahead to 2016, and see where we're going. But I thought we'd start off with a quick primer for those that might not be aware of the way you call it the three-tier system mm-hmm. of liquor distribution in Minnesota, how the product gets from the brewery to the shelf of the liquor store that I would go buy it from. It's a little more complicated than I think people realize. It's not as simple as, you know, a local brewery makes a nice IPA, puts it in a can, and then makes a deal with the liquor store to carry the product.
Right.
There's a lot more to it. So
yeah, and you know, you have to actually go way back to Prohibition, because a lot of these laws emanate out of, you know, the repeal of Prohibition. You know, mm-hmm. Prohibition, you know, the 18th Amendment, 1920. I think everybody agrees, probably one of the worst laws that ever been enacted in this country. And it was repealed in 1933. And when they went to repeal it, they did not have enough votes in the United States Senate for a clean repeal.
Okay.
So it was a compromise. Just like, you know, today we compromise on legislation. The compromise was that the states were allowed to regulate the liquor industry in their state.
Okay.
And so every state law...
Sounds reasonable on its surface.
Yeah, every state is different. So Prohibition was repealed, but the states now have the authority for the most part. I mean, the feds still have the Alcohol, Tobacco, Tax, and Trade Board that handles the collection of excise taxes, the granting of licenses, and things like that. But a lot of the nuts and bolts details of liquor law is a state-by-state thing.
Right.
So this three-tier system...
That's why you go in Wisconsin and you'll see, you know, beer available at a convenience store.
Exactly. Convenience stores, grocery stores on Sundays.
Right.
Because their laws are different than Minnesota's. So... Also coming out of Prohibition and the repeal of it is what we call the three-tier system. You know, there was before Prohibition, everybody was arguing that these, you know, big, you know, breweries were, you know, having their what they called tied houses. It was a saloon that they only sold their products. They would, you know, give away maybe free salty food as an enticement for the working man to come in there and spend a lot of money on their beer. And that's what the temperance movement was, you know, railing about was the influence that these breweries were having destroying society. So the three-tier system emanates out of this, the three tiers are manufacture, wholesale, and retail, meaning you have people that make it, you have people that sell it through wholesale channels, so from buy it from the manufacturer and then turn around and sell it to the retailer, mm-hmm. and then the retailers, you know, your bars, restaurants with liquor licenses, liquor stores, that then sell it to the general public.
Right.
Okay.
So before the beer gets in my hand, you know, it's already gone through three transactions.
Yeah. Generally speaking, but you've had a wholesaler buy. Now, there's some exceptions, we can talk about them, but the wholesaler buys it from the manufacturer and then sells it to the retailer. So you've got two transactions there. You're the third transaction when you go to buy it. And for the most part, and for many, many decades, this system worked just fine,
mm-hmm.
because you had big breweries, you know, in the 50s, you know, way back when you had a lot of small breweries. You know, this is not new what we have now with a lot of small local breweries. What happened was they consolidated in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, they started getting gobbled up. And so you had everything in the hands of either Anheuser-Busch or Miller or Heilemann. And they started, and so some of these laws were enacted or built upon at that time. And the concern was big breweries maybe abusing their clout with wholesalers, you know, forcing them to, you know, pay a higher price or only carry their products and all these things. So they, you know, they have different, there's a, Minnesota has a distribution law that has very tough termination provisions. It's very hard for a brewery to terminate a distributor.
Right.
And it comes out of that era where you had big breweries and smaller distributors. So flash forward to now, with this, you know, this craft revolution, with smaller, you know, local breweries, local smaller distilleries, and it's a little bit of the opposite. You have distributors consolidating.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So now
the power has shifted, the leverage has shifted, so from the breweries to the distributors.
Yeah, it hasn't necessarily shifted. It's just that you still have the Millers and the AB InBevs, and we're hearing now, you know, there's you know, this proposed merger, and there's Department of Justice investigations about what AB InBev is doing to try to push down craft beer. So you still have those big brewing conglomerates out there where this system works just fine. The question becomes, you know, what do we need to do to make it more flexible for these craft breweries, for these craft distilleries? And that's been a lot of what the legislation, the law changes have been, say, in the last 5 years, have been carve-outs to this general rule of the three-tier system. So you have breweries being able to sell growlers, 750-milliliter bottles, directly from the brewery. Right. That's an exception to the three-tier system. Tap rooms, when the Surly bill passed 5 years ago, that's an exception to the three-tier system. Okay, now, you know, tap rooms allowed to be open on Sundays. Tap rooms, this last session, tap rooms, you know, breweries now being allowed to sell growlers on Sundays. All of these things are carve-outs to this general rule of you either make it, you're a wholesaler, or you sell it at retail.
Right.
And so that's what has been kind of the push-pull at the, you know, in each state legislature, is how do they figure out that balance, and what carve-outs do you come up with to make this, to because everybody wants to promote your local, you know, craft brewery, craft distillery, because you're promoting local businesses, you increase jobs, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But you also have to think of this other piece of the big behemoth and how they could somehow exploit some of these. If you made a blanket repeal of a rule or change something, then you might be allowing one of these behemoths to exploit it. That's why a lot of these exceptions are capped based on production level.
Okay. How many approximately craft breweries, small breweries do we have in Minnesota currently?
I don't have an exact number, but it's got to be somewhere around 125.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's between 100 and 150 was the number I most recently have heard.
And I can tell you from anecdotally from what I've got on the table, more to come.
Oh yeah. They're popping up all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
How many distributors are there?
Maybe a tenth of that.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's not as many. If you're opening up a brewery and you're getting product out and you want to get your product out to the retail level, you know, you want to be more than just a local tap room that people can come to.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to go into contract. You've got to go into business with a distributor. And as you said, it's tough to get out of those contracts once you get in.
Yeah, now you can self-distribute up until the point where you get to 20,000 barrels of production. So your Summit, your Surly, Shells, they have to sign up with a distributor. Their capacity is above that, right?
Okay.
Most of the Minnesota breweries right now are below that, but they choose to go with a distributor because, you know, it's a pain in the butt to have to handle distribution. You have to, you have to have your trucks, and you have to maintain them, and you have to have personnel to drive and sell and handle that stuff.
And negotiate with all the stores to get some shelf space.
If you can find a good distributor with relationships with bars and restaurants and liquor stores, then you sign up with them, and you focus on what you do, which is making good product.
Right.
And then you let the distributor build the marketing channels. The problem has been, and this is what gets back to this, the distribution law, there are a lot of great distributors out there. There are some, though, that aren't really the best equipped to handle a lot of this craft beer, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But under the law, if a small distributor decides to sell out to a big distributor, the brewery with very narrow exceptions, has to go along with it. They have no say in it. They don't have a
window there where they can
There's very narrow grounds for how they could terminate their relationship. It has to be a severe adverse effect on their business to go with this particular distributor. And of course, it ends up in court. It's expensive. Small breweries, small distilleries don't have that kind of money. And with distilleries can't. The only self-distribution they have is to sell one 375-milliliter bottle per customer per day. They don't have any other self-distribution rights at this time.
Wow.
They can do cocktail rooms, and they can sell one 375 per day per customer, which is better than like North Carolina. North Carolina says one per customer per year.
Per year?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a special occasion.
Enjoy it.
Merry Christmas.
All right. Savor it.
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about some of the advances that were made in liquor laws in 2015 and what to look forward to in 2016. We're with Jeffrey O'Brien, Walter Hudson, Nick Zerwas, plus your calls, 651-989-5855.
Don't miss a minute of the best local talk in the Twin Cities. Check out the on-demand page at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com for podcasts from Up and Adam, including the always popular Post Show podcast, as well as the TCNT Podcast Network.
Show Up and Adam. I am Andrew Lee. Jack Tomczak back on Monday.
No!
We're talking beer. We're talking liquor. We're talking alcohol because Jack's not here and I can do what I want.
I was under the impression that you were the boss.
I am, but I'm a very accommodating boss.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to listen to Jack whine.
That
me
is a
plus
solid
Jack
point.
Whining.
It's a good point.
Very solid point.
Nick Zerwas and Walter Hudson, kind enough to sit in here for the last show of 2015. And lawyer extraordinaire, knows the Minnesota liquor scene inside and out. Jeffrey O'Brien is joining us as well.
I wish I could put that lawyer extraordinaire title on my card.
I've nice. Told you should. Apparently there's some
issue with the lawyer ethics board.
Yeah. Lawyers and ethics. Isn't that an oxymoron?
Could it say best lawyer ever?
What he needs is like three business cards.
Yeah.
So it's not really on one, but you just kind of hand them out in succession.
Like dealing cards.
All right. So we had, for those of us that, care about the Sunday sales issue, it comes up every session at the legislature. And you always get the sort of mixed bag of people that push for it. And then a bunch of other people are like, why do you care about this so much? It's not important. But for those of us that do care about it, this was a year that saw some gains. Mm-hmm. The door creaked open a little bit and some light got into the room of Sunday sales in that the tap rooms and breweries are now allowed to be open on Sundays. And if you are so inclined and if you have a tap room near you and a tap room whose product you like, you can go to that place and get a growler of beer mm-hmm. on Sundays. This has been in effect for about half the year. I think it started in summertime. It went into effect late summer.
Yeah. Yep. I think it was late May when the first cities, because the cities had to allow it.
Right.
And
right.
I think that was the first wave. I remember going out to Hayes Public House in Buffalo, which is a client of mine. They were one of the first weekends where you could go do it.
Okay. And the last time I checked, the state was not on fire.
Nope.
No, chaos had not erupted.
Well, not because of this.
The anarchy was not reigning in the streets because some people were able to get some growlers on Sundays.
Right.
Okay, so that's good.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. That was probably the in terms of liquor laws, that's probably the big headline coming out of 2015. Would you agree?
I would say that plus, there was the vote in the House and the Senate on a full repeal, and it was the closest it's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, before it was...
Thank you, Nick Zerwas.
Yes, exactly. Thank you.
I got him candy for that. That's the whole reason.
Oh, wow. That's why?
That's my personal form of lobbying.
It's effective.
And there was an interesting, I forget who it was. It was a state representative from, I think, the Burnsville area, tweeted out a statistic after that vote in the House that of the members that voted on that full repeal, I think 66% of the members, three terms or less, voted for full repeal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
33% of the members, four terms or more, voted against repeal. So I look at that as a positive. I look at this as a fait accompli. It is only a matter of time.
Oh, yeah.
Before this is repealed. Right. It may be one more election. We got both the House and the Senate up, you know, in 2016. It may be 2017. It may be 2019. It's going to happen at some point. And, you know, people are just puzzled as to why it's still here. And now, when you understand enough about the industry and the players and the financial interests, you understand why it's still here.
And that's kind of what I want to get into real quick here, is because on the surface, if you don't really dig into it and you don't pay close attention, I think a lot of people, my assumption would be a lot of people just look at it as it's a social conservative resistance. You've got, you know, it's
it was law. At one time.
It's a blue law.
Yeah, it started out as a blue law.
Yeah, and so you would assume that most of the opposition to it would come from people who want to respect the sanctity of Sundays. Sundays is supposed to be about going to church and spending time with your family and not boozing it up with a six-pack of beer.
Yeah, we got 6 days of the week to booze it up. We go to church on Sunday, folks. That's the way it works.
When you really start digging into this, you really start learning about it, I'm just fascinated at how multi-pronged and complex the opposition to Sunday sales really is.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more to it. In fact, the social conservative side of it is probably one of the most
small,
the most diminished facets of resistance to this anymore.
Yep.
It's about labor unions.
Yep.
It's about municipal liquor stores. It's about the fear of beer and liquor being sold in grocery stores plays a part in it. You've got a lot of different factions all sort of coalescing around this issue to help protect the status quo.
Right. Right. Yeah. The fear of it being, you know, being sold in convenience stores and grocery stores, I think, is if you had of all the different forces, that's probably one of the largest. And I would say the municipal liquor stores as well, because here's what's also going on the market side outside of all this legislation is you have Target now opening liquor stores.
Yep.
You have Total Wine coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Lunds and Byerly's have always had liquor stores. Cub Foods has liquor stores. Right. Sam's Club has liquor stores. There is a... You can, you know, whether or not independent liquor stores have a long shelf life here, whether or not municipal liquor stores have a long shelf life in the wake of these market changes, is a lot of what's driving this desire to keep this from the parties that support it. They want to keep it in place almost like a firewall against the free market.
Right. Yes. Yes.
You know, I joke.
That's a really good way to put it.
And I, you know, I'm more of the free market guy. So, you know, I've said this is essentially the buggy whip manufacturers protecting against the automobile coming in.
Yep.
I totally agree.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like the law, the three-tier system, the Sunday sales ban, what have you, it acts kind of like a truss around which the current market has grown, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody has staked out their territories based upon where the boundaries are currently drawn. And mm-hmm. so when you suggest messing up the truss or eliminating the boundary, suddenly you're shaking up everybody's world, right? And you're actually making them have to think about what it would be like to compete in a free market. What am I going to do when I actually have to provide a better product, when I actually have to figure out how to get it from point A to point B, and I actually have to compete with all these other forces that could potentially do it better? The sky is falling. No, we can't have that.
Yeah. And I just wish that the proponents of the status quo, the proponents of keeping the ban, would be honest about their opposition, because the arguments that you hear is, well, you know, it's our overhead's going to go up because we're going to have to maybe open a seventh day and we're not going to be able to afford that, and it's spreading out 6 days worth of business over 7 days. Those arguments fall flat on their face.
Absolutely.
When you look at what goes on in states that do allow Sunday sales, and when you look at examples that, you know, that we even see with growlers being available on Sundays, do you hear tap rooms complaining that, oh, it's just six days of growler sales spread out
right.
over.
And there's not even there's been proposals of, okay, let's have it be a local option. Okay, let's let the, you know, those liquor stores that are along the Wisconsin border that are losing business on Sundays, let them have the option of opening.
Mm-hmm.
there is a very much a slippery slope mentality when it comes to this issue, that if we allow any of it, somehow it's going to slide and we're going to end up in convenience stores and grocery stores. Now, I will say this. I was out, and we've talked about this on the BeerCast. I was out at the Craft Brewers Conference in Portland, Oregon earlier this year in April. And one of the things that they've said is they've identified as one of the number one growth markets for craft beer, convenience stores.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
certainly.
Yeah.
And you're talking about a state like Oregon, where 53% of the beer sold in the state of Oregon is brewed in the state of Oregon. And by all the data we have about Minnesota, we may be at 10%.
Wow.
So we have.
With as much good beer as being made.
And part of it is, I think, some of these, you know, legal chokeholds that have been put on this system and maintained. I think if some of these things were loosened up, I do think we would probably start to increase that market share over that 10% number.
To get to the over that 10% number to ever even compete with what's going on in Oregon, you know, the beer has to be available in more places.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one of the keys.
I mean,
you've got to be able to get it from wherever you are.
And the other issue, too, is we go back to talking about the distribution laws again. A number of states, like I said, every state's different. A number of states have adopted what they call a small brewer exemption to these beer distribution laws, meaning that these, you know, like, for example, Minnesota, you can have a distribution agreement without having a written contract. So if you hand a keg of beer to a distributor to go test at a liquor store, you have your distributor.
Yeah, you might be locked
in
at that point.
And good luck because you're not married to them. You can only terminate them with cause, and you have to give them 90 days notice and an opportunity to cure whatever the cause is. And it's very narrow in the statute. So when we draft these distribution agreements, you know, we have to be very artful about the language we use to make sure that anything of a quality control or marketing nature could be even considered cause. And that only just gives them 90 days to fix whatever they screwed up.
Right.
A lot of states have started to adopt, I think about 12 states so far, and there's always new proposals, a small brewer exemption whereby if you're below a certain production amount, which most of our local craft breweries are, then you have different rules when it comes to termination. It's easier. It's more of a typical, you know, contract arrangement where you don't have one party having so much leverage versus the other party. So that's another thing. You know, the breweries are starting to get organized politically. We were talking off air. I got invited to a fundraiser for some members of the House Commerce Committee. They're getting it. They understand. We've probably gone as far as we can just based on pure common sense in terms of changing these laws. Now they're going to have to get in there, play the game, talk to the legislators, and realize that have their say and their place at the table alongside the wholesalers and the retailers.
If we could just rely on common sense, it would have passed a long time ago. Clearly, there are a lot of other forces at play,
right?
and that's where I think, for me, in my second term, it's been one of the most interesting discussions to watch at the Capitol, as you watch where different groups of people line up and align.
Mm-hmm.
I was a first-term lawmaker who came out of a city council with a pretty robust municipal liquor operation. And my first year didn't really hear from constituents around Sunday sales at all, but it heard from my cities that I represent saying, hey, we don't like this. If this comes up, vote against this.
Right.
And I didn't run for the state legislature
to overturn Sunday sales. That wasn't one of your key issues. Right.
Wasn't in the top 100. And so the first year, I said, okay, yeah, I won't change Sunday sales. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
That's what my city wants.
Yeah, that's what specifically the municipals, correct?
Yep.
So they were asking you to do, and those were the only people you were hearing from.
Yeah. So I thought, okay.
Remember, we got into it on the show a couple of times about it.
Well, then really weird things start to happen as you see the different relationships, where suddenly the Teamsters lobbyist in his suit with his slicked back hair, I'd see him in the hallway at the Capitol, And he'd go, Zerwas, you're still with me, right? And he'd give me two thumbs up. I go,
wait, what?
What just happened?
What's going on here? Why am I with the Teamsters?
What just happened here? And so it was really after watching this play out over a year, it took to understand the different relationships, how it broke down, and just how complex and how many moving parts are involved in something that on the surface looks as basic and simple
From a consumer standpoint.
I want to walk into a store and buy a beer on a Sunday.
Yeah, there's a person there that's willing to engage in this transaction with me that I want to engage in, and it shouldn't matter that it's Sunday or Saturday or Tuesday or Wednesday. Yep. I've got somebody who's got a product I want that I want to buy. Why can't I engage two willing partners engage in this transaction without government interference?
I completely agree. Just real briefly, I completely agree with Jeffrey that we are on track.
To
reverse the Sunday sales ban, I think the movement in the House vote particularly is encouraging, and the fact that then the Senate vote was even more encouraging than people thought, and that was with it having previously failed in the House. I firmly believe if the Senate had voted first, the House would have passed it.
Yeah.
This last time around.
But don't let that inevitability, you know, for those of you that do care about this.
Oh, absolutely.
Don't let that inevitability stop you from keeping the pressure on, because it's inevitable only as long as the pressure remains there.
Yes. Right.
From the interested parties.
And if you are going to go to a caucus, and if you are going to be a delegate in your local Republican BPOU, where all Republican candidates or legislators are going to have to talk to you in hopes of getting your endorsement in order to be elected or to continue serving. Let those folks know, I am a delegate, I am a committed party activist, and this is one of the things.
Yeah, this is on my radar. This is an issue that's important to me.
This
doesn't have to be the only issue.
No.
You know, it doesn't have to be the...
And you should say, not just Republicans, Democrats do. This does cut... It's really more of a generational thing than a party line issue.
Yep. Good point, Jeffrey.
Absolutely.
And if this is an important issue to you, ask whoever is running what their position is and vote for the one that supports what you believe.
Yep. Christian in Andover, real quick before we go to break. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, everybody. One thing quick. How many people does it take in St. Louis Park before you become an excited group of people protesting? Is it more than four?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm not sure I follow.
Sorry. That's a bad joke. I'll let it go. So here's the thing.
Christian, what the heck?
How long can you live? If you have more than four people, is it protesting? If you get excited about Black Lives Matter doing something, is it a counter-protest? Anyway, Andrew, how long have you lived in Minnesota?
5.5 years.
Okay, so you've not been here. You are not here in the glorious pre-2 a.m. close that was Minnesota back in 2003, I think it started.
Okay.
The same kind of thing was bandied about, how bad things are going to get. It's going to turn us into a horribly dystopian future where we're going to be, you know, Mad Maxing beyond Thunderdome between bars between 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what happened? It's the same stupid logic that we can't control ourselves and everything will be just out of control.
Right. Yeah, they want you to believe that, you know, the only thing standing between you and chaos and anarchy are these laws. You know, that we force bars to close early, or that we force liquor stores to close on Sunday. The only thing standing between us and just the collapse of society are these silly blue laws.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks, Christian.
Sunday sales.
Hashtag Sunday sales. We're going to do one more segment on this. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the opposition to Sunday sales, and I want to get into the future of municipal liquor stores in the state of Minnesota. We're here with Jeff O'Brien, Walter Hudson, Nick Zerwas, plus your call, 651-989-5855.